Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? He kind of does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at npr.org/podcasts. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. On this week's show, we'll dig into the Netflix series Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. We'll talk about its extraordinary silliness, the tricky questions around its employment of stereotypes, and that unforgettable theme music. Then we'll try to find the solution to the problem of when culture that's inspired by other work becomes what we derisively call derivative, whether it's critters that look an awful lot like hobbits or songs that sound a lot like Iggy Pop. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, including a great essay about an essential word and a hypothetical boyfriend we can all get behind. Don't go away. We've got mole women and mere pretenders to come, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Next to me is Stephen Thompson. Stephen, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week in our fourth chair is Kat Chow. Kat, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer for NPR's Code Switch team.
So, on March 6th, Netflix began streaming all 13 episodes of the comedy Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, created by Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, who also worked together on a little show called 30 Rock. It stars Ellie Kemper as a woman who's rescued after 15 years from an underground compound where she was held by the leader of a doomsday cult. That might not sound like the setup for a whimsical comedy, but in fact, it's a pretty profoundly silly piece of work. One of the things that was interesting for us is that we had a conversation about whether we could still talk about Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, given that it became available an entire 3.5 weeks ago.
Yeah, it's old news.
Yeah, we're getting down to a very, very narrow window for talking about our new shows. As a matter of fact, Glenn had talked about this show a few weeks ago as the thing making him happy, so I thought I would start with Glenn. What is it that you like about this show?
Well, I was a little worried about it going in because all the pre-art for it, all the marketing for it was just Ellie Kemper smiling, being a Pollyanna, being sunny, and that just didn't necessarily have a lot of appeal to me. What I love about this show, as I've mentioned before, is joke density. Jokes keep coming. They're also undercut by a darkness. There's jokes like 1996 called, it wants its clothes back. Oh yeah, well 2090 called, you're dead and you wasted your life. That's a good little back and forth. There's also a scene where she talks about trying to fall asleep counting sheep, and then she starts wondering, because of her background, why are these sheep jumping over the fence? What's chasing them? All good stuff that comes really quickly. Ellie Kemper as a performer also does end up appealing to me a lot. She is doing this thing where she is riding a line between naive and smart. She is also a very self-assured character, but she's not self-deluded or self-important. That's important. The theme song was another thing that appealed to me.
Yeah, today I was hanging out with our producer, Jessica Reedy, and I was walking down with her, and I was saying, Unbreakable, they alive, damn it.
Yep. When you churn through the episodes as you can, you invariably skip the theme song. Not here. Every single time, all 13 episodes, I listen to it incompletely. And then finally, this music video that the character of Titus Andromedon does, called Pinot Noir. You know, it kind of split the world in half. I will always think of it as there was a time before Pinot Noir and a time after it, because I was at a bar the other day and a woman comes up with her two gay friends and she orders a Pinot Noir and they sit there and they do nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. And it's like, get better gay dudes. Because if that was you and me, Linda Holmes, and you ordered a Pinot Noir, I'd be there with Terry Garr.
Jamie Farr.
Would you really?
Riding a funicular. I wouldn't sing it.
Yeah.
I'm not a monster.
But right. You'd say it.
But I would say it. Yeah. So I'm totally in on this thing. Love it to death.
Yeah, Pinot Noir is this show's muffin top.
Yeah.
You know, we're inevitably going to talk about comparisons between this show and 30 Rock. 30 Rock has that great bit where Jenna sings an incredibly cheesy dance pop hit, kind of in the spirit almost of like Don't Be Tardy for the Party from the Real Housewives. and yes, Pinot Noir, which they do a lot of good work with on the show, is definitely a standout. I had an interesting reaction to this show where I started watching, obviously, from the very beginning. The first joke in the show didn't land for me. And it's just a throwaway thing where the women in this doomsday cult are reciting something. I'm like, yeah, that joke's kind of flat. And then all of a sudden, boom, 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 boom.
No, I agree with you.
There are four or five hilarious jokes in a row. There are visual gags popping on the screen. There is commentary on the media and the way the media are covering this story. And then you get the media interviewing the neighbor who starts talking, and it's very much in the spirit of the bed intruder guy who inspires the mashup, auto-tuned remix. And then they just start remixing it and it becomes the theme song for the show. And you just realize this show is getting where it's going so incredibly quickly. I was hooked by the time the opening credits of the first episode were over.
Yeah.
I really love this show. It has its flaws, but Glenn mentioned the darkness. You have the darkness of the backstory constantly undercutting the brightness of the lead character and vice versa in a way that the tension there I found enormously appealing.
It's interesting to realize that they have in fact made such a silly, silly comedy about such a terrible story. And one of the things that's interesting to me is they don't do what it has to have been tempting to do, which is spend all of their time on jokes about the 15 years that she's missed and all the things she doesn't know about the world. They go back to those things at times. There's a moment where her stepfather?
Stepfather.
Her stepfather says something about, "That's How I Met Your Mother." And then he says something like, "Which was a great TV show that you missed, but now you can binge watch it on Netflix." And
her references are like Moesha.
Yep.
Exactly. But they don't spend all their time on the jokes about that 15-year gap. And I think for the most part, they show some restraint about that fact. Now, Kat, first I want to ask you, did you enjoy this show on the whole?
Yes, I did. I actually watched it twice in the same weekend. And even the second time around, it didn't disappoint. I still enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. And Kat, you also wrote a great, I'm going to say, piece at Code Switch, as we taped this last week, about the character of Dong, who is a Vietnamese immigrant who becomes a potential love interest for Kimmy, played by Ellie Kemper. And can you talk a little bit about sort of the controversy that kicked that, that kicked that off?
Yeah. So Dong is played by an actor named Ki Hong Lee. And as a character, Dong is a bunch of things that you wouldn't really want an Asian American character to be. He is, one, good at math. He has an accent. He works as a delivery guy for a Chinese restaurant. He bikes food around. And he also has this deeply seated paranoia that he's going to be deported.
Right.
And so I remember when I was first watching Unbreakable, I had this gut reaction when I first saw Dong where I was like, oh no, his name is Dong, which is a throwback to 16 Candles Long Duk Dong, who, if you grew up in the 80s, you were probably taunted by Oh Sexy Girlfriend and, and lines from that movie. And so you have this character named Dong who everybody just has this gut reaction to of, oh no, not another one of these.
That he's kind of a parade of stereotypes and caricature and stuff.
Exactly. Like, and they're just so in your face. And I think everybody was a little bit nervous. But then you also have this idea that he is a romantic lead, which there isn't that much of in TV sitcoms, besides John Cho in Selfie, which only lasted like, six episodes.
And more's the pity because he was extremely charming on that show.
He is extremely charming in general.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you have this dynamic where what makes Dong really incredibly foreign is also what sets him up to be a good character in Unbreakable, where the reason why he seems like such a good fit to be Kimmy's partner is also because he is foreign and they're sort of experiencing the world together. But what I think is really important and interesting to think about and consider when you watch Unbreakable is that It's all about how you see the show and what context you're viewing it. So if you look at Unbreakable and if you look at Dong just from the perspective of the show, his character totally makes sense because you're like, yeah, I mean, this is why they're together, because they're so similar in certain ways, or why they would work together. But if you look at Dong in the landscape of Asian American men, specifically in TV, that's where it gets a little uncomfortable.
Sure.
Because, I mean, you just see these stereotypes appearing as a parade, like you were saying before, Linda. I think, Linda, you and I had been talking about this a while ago when I was writing this essay, about how characters can still have these accents and be these traits, but not necessarily be bad.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was very interesting when you wrote that piece, quite candidly, is that you talked in the piece about, you said, I'm good at math.
Mm-hmm. I'm okay at math.
Yeah. I am Asian. I worked at a Chinese restaurant. And my name is Kat Chow, which sometimes people like to make a big thing about. And I noticed, like, the thing that was amazing to me was there were actually people who were trying to kind of get at the point that you were making in this piece while also saying, is that really her name? And I thought, this is such a fascinating glimpse into... Yeah. Kind of what you were saying, which was like, so what that he's good at math? He can't be good at math. So what that he works at a Chinese restaurant?
Yeah, do you have to puncture every stereotype? And is that true to any number of characters?
And especially stuff like, what's wrong with the fact that he has an accent?
Right.
And I think, like you said, it's the scarcity that makes everything feel so loaded in part.
Yeah.
And what to me is interesting about that character in the context of the show, it's all caricatures. It's all types.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we were talking earlier about Muffin Top and Jenna Maroney on 30 Rock. The character that Jane Krakowski plays on this show is a very much a Real Housewives type, who is a monstrous person most of the time. The character Titus that Glenn was talking about earlier, who sings Pinot Noir, is a black gay man who eventually there's a bit where he finds out that he's treated better when he's dressed as a werewolf.
Oh my God, which is maybe my favorite
which
bit.
Is and Kimmy herself is very much a caricature of sort of the wholesome Midwestern, cheerful, chipper girl who shows, it's like a very extreme version of this idea of the girl who comes to New York and is fresh-faced and from the country. And so everyone on this show is a type. It's both more comfortable and less comfortable, but I did come to feel over time like the show was for the most part on the right side of commenting upon the expectations that those types bring rather than just employing them. Although I acknowledge that's a very, very, very tricky line.
Right.
Yeah, it is.
Well, one of the reasons I liked Kat's piece so much is that it embraced exactly that nuance. Both of those things can be equally true. There is an element of this that there's always been this in Tina Fey and Robert Carlock's comedy. It goes back to 30 Rock and even goes back actually to Weekend Update when some of her SNL stuff, that there is, we can joke about this because we are so obviously the good guys. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. You can do that. You just got to be able to deal with the reaction you get. You can't just throw up your hands and shout censorship as soon as somebody goes, oh, really, that?
Mm-hmm.
And conspicuously, they are staying out of the news. They are not saying a word. They are just letting it go out there and be the thing it is. And along the same lines, the character of Titus, I mean, whenever you see a character like this who is so flamboyantly gay and is the sidekick, you just scan, like you're the Terminator. You just scan it, and your first thing is this an attack from outside? Or the calls coming from inside the house. And clearly, with the character of Titus, the calls are coming from inside the house. I felt the same way, actually, with Jack on Will and Grace. The difference here is that Jack was a flat character. Titus seems to me to be a flat character who has the potential to become a round character. I'm destroying E.M. Forster here, but basically...
No, I agree with that.
But flat characters are, you know, the ones that every time you go to them, they do their thing.
Right.
They have one thing that they do, and they do it dependably, and you go to them for that. Round characters have the capacity to legitimately surprise you. Mm-hmm. And we are learning more about Titus with each episode, and we're getting to a place we're seeing about his backstory and things like that. So he has a range of... doing that thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have seen a lot of stuff online about how he is a flamboyant gay character, but I just want to say that flamboyancy, queeniness, is a important part of the gay experience, capital G, capital E. It's a vital, it's a strong, it's a sexy, it's a very important part. And to deny that it's there is just dumb. And to condemn it is also, we're not...
It sort of goes back to, why can't you have an accent? Why can't you be good
it's
at
same,
that?
It's the same conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, I also think it's wrong to mandate it and say, well, this is what gay characters are, because that's what we used to do in the 70s. And so, like, all these characters, like the gay prostitutes on Barney Miller, were that, and that's all you saw. It's exactly the same point the cat was making. If that's all you see, we now have a range. And so he belongs, and he's great.
He is really great.
I think in general in comedy, you're able to get away with so much more when you are funny, when the jokes are there, and when you're fundamentally good-natured. And one thing about this show that I noticed as it rolls along is it's gathering more and more momentum. And I don't think the stories of any of these characters are done being written. You know, this is in one 13-episode block. They were all unleashed at the same time. And I think that as the second 13-episode block comes out, I do feel you're probably going to see more and more. They don't do that much with Dong's character in the first season, but there's no reason to believe that there won't be more to that character in the second, the way that Titus and the Carol Kane landlady, I mean, my God, Carol, I mean, genius casting.
Sure,
anything you put Carol Kane, just put Carol Kane in everything.
Funny.
And as these secondary and tertiary characters are fleshed out more and more and given more life, I think you're going to feel less flatness in some of those characters.
Yeah, and I do want to say, I respect the character development. I respect the performances. I respect all that stuff. I do want to acknowledge how much I just loved how extravagantly, energetically silly this show is, how welcome that was, and how much it reminded me of the things I loved the most about 30 Rock. And I think, you know, Stephen mentioned Carol Kane. There is a rhythm to the way that they learn over the course of this show to deploy Carol Kane, where they give her these lines where it's setup and punchline in one line.
Yeah,
and she
true.
Has a way of, in the first half of the sentence, she's setting you up for what you think the joke is or what you think the line is. And then the second half of it isn't that. The one that I remember, they are talking about high heels. And she says, well, you know, this was invented by a man because women have never invented anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you get the first half of that sentence and you think she's making the, like, you know, no woman would invent something like this, you know, because of blah, blah, blah. And then there's no pause. There's no pause for, like, to draw that out. She just says it. And I think she's absolutely brilliant in this. I think Ellie Kemper... Tina Fey is somebody who has muses, and I say Tina Fey here because I'm more familiar with her, but she and Carlock in creating this show, there are people who really seem to inspire them, and I think Ellie Kemper is kind of a perfect vehicle for the slightly manic way that Tina Fey has always written for people. There is another kind of, I think, muse of theirs who is in the show, who I don't want to entirely identify, but who plays the leader of kind of the Doomsday cult, whose performance in this show, perhaps even more than the other times that this person has partnered with them and with Tina Fey, is such a bizarre, bent presentation of a character. And I just absolutely loved it and could have watched episode upon episode of just that performance because it was extremely funny.
One thing that just jumps out so much about that Ellie Kemper performance is what a remarkable arsenal of smiles she has.
That's true.
Right.
She is able to smile meaningfully in like 25 different ways.
Yeah.
And they're all open, they're all expressive, and they're all saying something else about her. There's this wonderful scene where she's explaining that her mantra, one of the ways that she lived through these 15 horrible years underground, is that she lived everything 10 seconds at a time. And there's this amazing flashback scene where she's turning a big crank. And at the beginning of each 10 seconds, it's like she's fresh and new and just experiencing it for the first time. And by the end, she's straining. And then all of a sudden, she's bright again in the first 10 seconds. And it says so much about that character and so much of, like, an idea of, like, if you can pull that off, it's such a great way to live. There's some profundity and beauty to this show, in addition to just joke after joke, it just having that incredibly appealing lead at the center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they get a lot of comedy out of that crank. Well, we'll be very interested to hear from you about whether you've watched Kimmy Schmidt and whether you enjoyed it. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be talking about some of the blessings and some of the limitations of art that's in the tradition of other art. So stick around.
Hi, I'm Michael, and I'm calling from New York City. Thanks to our sponsor, Loot Crate. It's a monthly subscription box service for epic geek and gamer items and pop culture gear. Each month, Loot Crate will send you a box with 6 to 8 unique and one-of-a-kind items that include licensed gear, apparel, and collectibles. April's fantasy-themed Loot Crate will include items from your favorite fantasy franchises, including Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, and The Princess Bride. But you only have until April 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe. Head to lootcrate.com/NPR and enter code NPR to save 10% on any new subscription.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. One of the questions some of us had while we were watching Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt was its close stylistic connections that we've been talking about to Tina Fey and Robert Carlock's other show, 30 Rock. We want to talk a little this week about the idea of things that might be described as derivative and when we do and don't mind that being the case. Stephen, I wonder if I can ask you to talk about an example that you gave that involves an Iggy Pop song.
If you want to get me mad very quickly, you know how
and
like...
I do.
You do. You know how like actors have to access some memory that will make them cry if they need to cry in a given moment? If you want to get my dander up in a big hurry, talk about the Jet song from about 15 or 20 years ago called Are You Gonna Be My Girl? And the opening riff of Are You Gonna Be My Girl goes da 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 na 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 da na da 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 na 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 na.
So 1, 2, 3, take my hand and come with me because you look so fine that I really wanna make you mine.
And it is very, very similar to the opening riff to the song Lust for Life.
Right. Which you may have seen in cruise ship commercials.
Yeah, which inspired an Onion story from years and years ago. A song about heroin used to advertise bank. and Lust for Life,
has had its own curious
has
life.
Has had its own curious lifespan. But the song by Jet, which was just this incredibly derivative garage band, their big hit was, particularly in its first 30 to 45 seconds, a copy of an also well-known song. Now, the Jet song started being used in commercials. That's where derivativeness goes from, hey, there are only so many chords and only so many ideas, and you know the folk tradition, we're all pulling from a grand tapestry of different styles, to here is a way to take the money that this musician should be making and make it for ourselves. And that, to my mind, is where derivativeness becomes very ugly and very anger-inducing.
It's cynical.
Yeah.
Cynical.
I get that. How about you, Glenn?
When I was in fourth grade, I burned through all of Tolkien, talked about this before, even the Silmarillion, which, as I said before, was tough going. Even for a fan of umlauts and italics like me, it's rough. I got it done, and I asked my friend, what's next, what's next, what's next? And he pointed me to a book called The Sword of Shannara by Terry L. Brooks, which is Tolkien methadone. It is Tolkien, it's a Tolkien cover band. It doesn't start out by saying, in a hole in the ground, there lived a schmobbit, but it's very close to
schmobbit.
Very, very close to that.
Yeah.
With all of the stuff in place, all the big dark lord is the thing, and there's a plucky young outsider who must go and do the quest. Now, a lot of people out there are right now picking up their copy of The Hero with a Thousand Faces and saying, this is just quest, this is just epic mythology, this is exactly that. But this book was a direct, like, transliteration, it felt like. It's exactly what I wanted when I was in fourth grade, but now it feels very thin. There are other people who've taken this same tradition of the high fantasy, epic fantasy, whatever you want to call it, and twisted it, mostly by doing something interesting with it, like taking it out of the realm of good versus evil, light versus dark, and trying to insert something else, a more ambiguity. Like Michael Moorcock did this a series with an anti-hero. It's more chaos versus order. Now, you can say that's a distinction without a difference, but it's different. The main thing that's driving George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire and the Game of Thrones is this idea that there's not good versus evil, because everybody is on this sort of gray moral spectrum. And there is kindness versus ruthlessness. The fascinating thing to me about his books are that ruthlessness is rewarded.
Yeah.
Ruthlessness wins. Ruthlessness is strength.
Right.
Kindness is weakness. Kind people don't last very long. So it's the idea of taking these tropes and instead of simply iterating them, finding something new within them.
Yeah.
Finding and making something new.
Yeah.
Attaching a philosophy to them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, or and a different, something different to say. And I was telling Glenn earlier, I was recently re-listening to an episode of the great Judge John Hodgman podcast that Glenn and I are both fans of, where one friend had wanted another friend to read a series of 14 books. Which now I'm not going to remember what series it is.
The Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time,
Wheel of Time. Yes, yeah. It was Wheel of Time. And one of the things that Judge Hodgman said was exactly this, that most high fantasy is Tolkien ripoff, I think he originally said. But then he talked about this whole idea of kind of everything coming from this, but also inspired by old hero stories and the entire, like, that everything is epic, everything is quests. And so it can be hard to figure out exactly where on that scale you are, you know, how much are you stealing from one thing and how much are you just following a grand tradition?
Right.
You
know? So when I was thinking about this topic of derivativeness, I kept going back to the idea of how we speak in public radio, because I think there's a blog post that's circulating right now from, I think it was from dig.com. Someone imitated how people speak on This American Life. And a couple months back, Code Switch, we did a Twitter chat called Pub Radio Voice, where we were trying to tease out the ideas of how people actually sound. And I know this sounds really navel-gazy because this is an NPR podcast.
No, we did an entire episode about it.
Right.
So we have nothing to say
and
about
navel-gazing. I guess that's what I always think about when I think about derivativeness, how we all are maybe starting to sound the same, or how some people think we do, we as in the collective whole of public radio.
Well, no, but I think you're right. And I think one of the questions that I've heard people ask off of that whole phenomenon of not just the conversation that you guys had, but the conversation about people who sound a lot like Ira Glass is, at what point is this public radio and at what point is this just people who've worked for Ira? You know what I mean?
Because
the tentacles of Ira Glass are lengthy and powerful and wrapped around many, many of the ships and submarines of public radio. Wow. That went to
really good imagery.
That went to quite a place. But my point is, like, it's one thing to be derivative in general, to say, like, I started my show over here and I'm talking like I think people on public radio talk. It's another thing to have actually worked for Ira. And so you talk like Ira because you've worked for him. And a lot of these people who people are talking about when they say people on public radio sound the same, a lot of those people in some way trace back to the family tree of This American Life and some of those shows. I think the point that Kat makes is a really good one, because there's a difference between everybody's just turning into the same thing because everybody's trying to be the same thing, and many things share DNA, actual DNA. They're not just derivative to be derivative, but they actually have a reason why they have things in common with each other.
Right.
And I think that's true of music, too, and it's true of television. And you'll see, like, when you look at Mad Men, there are people who point out similarities between, like, a show like Mad Men and a show like The Sopranos. And one way to look at that is, well, that's inspired by the success of The Sopranos and the success of HBO. The other way to look at it is Matt Weiner worked on The Sopranos.
Right.
It can be hard to figure out what's derivative in the sense that you watched it and took it in, and what's derivative in the sense that you learned from whoever made it.
Yeah, it's always complicated. I have a musical example. Jess, would you play clip one?
I can't define love when it's not.
That's Talking Heads.
I was going to say, that's Talking Heads, right?
Love Goes to Building on Fire, very early Talking Heads. Would you play clip two, please? That is a mid-aughts band called Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, a band I love because the Talking Heads sounded like they sounded in that one song for a while, and then they stopped sounding the way I like them to sound.
And started sounding different.
And I fetishize that early sound so much that when this band came along, and they were doing it, and everybody made the comparison. Everybody did.
Well, you can't not.
You can't not. But it just scratched this itch, this very specific itch that I wasn't even aware that I had. And I just love them. Now, I also saw a video of them performing somewhere. I think it was probably in Brooklyn. It was definitely Brooklyn. And it was an outside concert. And all of a sudden, the camera pans over to David Byrne rocking along. And it's like, aw. My black
blessing,
and tiny heart
blessing
melted.
Blessing from the Pope.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You hit on an interesting point, too, though, that that's a case, like a lot of my favorite derivative things, of somebody small imitating somebody big. Mm-hmm. And so you don't necessarily get the sense of it being predatory. You get a sense of it being adoring. A couple years ago, preparing for South by Southwest, I heard a band called Golden Youth, and they have a song called We Are Alive. Let's hear a little bit of it. I love this song, but you would never in a million billion years, if you're describing that song, say anything other than, that sounds like Yonsei from Sigur Rós. It's incredibly like mirror image of these big, robust, cheerful, stompy, clappy, pretty, on angel's wings songs that Yonsei does. Well, Yonsei's and Sigur Rós, those are large, epic concerns. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to hear Golden Youth, this indie band, and elevate them above Sigur Rós or think that they created that sound. And I think that that's part of when I like something derivative, it's just I like Yonsei. Yonsei can only make so many records. Yonsei can only write so many of those big, beautiful songs. So here's one that I like you said, scratches the same itch. There's nothing offensive about it. It's just more of what I like.
Yeah, it was interesting because when you bring that up, it makes me think of the season of American Idol when Philip Phillips won, and I heard the song Home,
yep.
That was his kind of victory song. It was one of the first ones that I had ever heard where I thought that might actually be a successful song,
right.
And it was. And it's in a ton of commercials, and it's because it sounded so much like what was going around then. It sounded so much like Mumford & Sons.
I think a lot of people thought it was Mumford & Sons.
Right. And so it sounds so much like the style of those bands, but it's not a copy of an individual particular song. And the thing that's interesting to me is I find Home much more derivative of Mumford & Sons than I find, for example, the Sam Smith song, Stay With Me, derivative of I Won't Back Down by Tom Petty, for which they wound up having to give Tom Petty a writing credit because literally the melody is very
right.
similar in places. Those are clearly not the same song. They have the notes that move in the same order, and I get that there are people who say that's the same song. But it's not to me. It's much less derivative than that Philip Phillips song and the Mumford & Sons song. Spiritually derivative, if I can say that. Not copyright derivative, but
well, and it's also
derivative.
Nobody then heard subsequent Mumford & Sons songs and thought they were Philip Phillips.
Right.
So Philip Phillips wasn't biting a chunk out of, I mean, maybe he contributed to people's Mumford & Sons fatigue.
That's true. That's probably true.
The way that Owl City probably perpetuated a little bit of Death Cab for Cutie fatigue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's not so much that like he suddenly laid claim to something that belonged to somebody else
right.
as he was like latching onto its coattails.
I think that's right.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
And, you know, it can start out being very, very derivative and then go on its own way. Superman came out in 1938, but for 20 years or so, he wasn't the top-selling superhero comic. Anybody guess who was? Who was? Anybody?
Captain Marvel?
Captain Marvel. Very good, Stephen.
It's in my blood.
Of course. Outsold Superman by millions every month. And it was, basically, instead of Clark Kent as a reporter, it was Billy Batson, a 12-year-old news announcer. Instead of Luther the Mad Bald Scientist, it was Dr. Savannah the Mad Bald Scientist. The same power sets. But very soon after Captain Marvel came on the scene, his writers decided to make him magic-based as opposed to science. Based. And they put around him this whole family of Hoppy the Marvel Bunny, Lieutenant Marvel, Fat Marvel, Tall Marvel, Uncle Marvel, Mary Marvel, all these other things around him.
Tartar Control Marvel.
Tartar Control Marvel is awesome. But then in 1953, finally, DC sued Fawcett to say, stop doing this. And because superhero comics were on their way out, Fawcett said, yeah, sure. That decision was presided over by Judge Learned Hand, no less.
Mm-hmm.
What happens then is that all the writers from Captain Marvel come over to Superman, and over the next 10, 15 years, we get Crypto the Superdog and Beppo the Supermonkey and Supergirl and this whole family around him. And the style gets a lot more similar to the old Captain Marvel. So a lot of the stuff that makes this character is just, it's just feeding back in on itself in this kind of recursive loop.
Yeah.
If Fawcett wanted to fight it in 1953, they probably could have, because by that time, they were such vastly different characters. But they decided it's not worth it, and they packed up their bags and went home.
Well, and there can be a fine line between derivative and homage.
Yeah,
you know? And I was thinking, Stephen, a long time ago, turned me on to a singer named Ryan Shaw, who is very much singing in the style of kind of 60s soul singers.
Sure.
But who I think is wonderful to listen to. And clearly, the style is learned from that. So when you hear somebody doing something that clearly they love, that's just in the style of the stuff that they grew up with and love, it's a little different. It's derivative, and yet we don't attach quite such a negative connotation to that. But I'll be interested to hear, again, what some of our folks think about that, think about this kind of stuff. And my guess is they have plenty of examples to back up. So make sure that you tell us what all of them are. Okay, when we come back, we will get to our favorite part of the show, What's Making Us Happy This Week, right after this.
Hi, I'm Adam, and I'm calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and this message are from TastingRoom.com, the only wine club that fits your personal tastes. Here's how it works. Tasting Room sends you a kit with sample-sized bottles of wine. You sip each one, log onto their site, and tell them which wines you liked. Tasting Room then picks wines for you based on your tastes. You get your first full case 1 month later. The shipments come every 3 months from when you started. Visit TastingRoom.com/NPR for the wine club where your taste is the only one that matters.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. That brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
We are in a fairly glorious time of year for music. Late March, early April is one of those times of year where at NPR Music, we are suddenly staring down like 5, 6, 7, 8 albums that we're profiling in our first listen series, because we have so much to choose from. And this is where some of the best albums of the year come out. And one that I had the privilege of writing about for NPR Music actually a week or two ago, it's no longer on the site, but it's out now and it's wonderful, is an album called Carrie and Lowell by Sufjan Stevens. And we've talked about Sufjan Stevens on the show before. We've talked a lot about like his Christmas records, but it's been a while since he's made a record in that classically pretty, very delicate, very melancholy way that people who, first discovered him kind of in the early to mid aughts fell in love with. You know, records like Illinois and Michigan, you know, that have these beautiful, extremely delicate jewels on them. He had gotten away from that a little bit and was making more idiosyncratic, exploratory records like The Age of Odds that go in a bunch of different directions. You know, he made an electro-pop record over here and an instrumental recording about the Brooklyn Queens Expressway over here. And this record, Carrie and Lowell, is him pulling back in and singing about life again and singing about death again. It's at least partially inspired by the death of his mother, with whom he had a very limited and complicated relationship. There is a fantastic interview with Sufjan Stevens in Pitchfork, which we will link to. It is this incredible story that he tells. It's a terrific interview. And this record is just beautiful. It's so delicate and sweet and dark, and it could only have come from him and from his songwriting voice. Let's actually hear a little taste of the song No Shade in the Shadow of the Cross, which may be the Sufjan Stevens-iest song title ever.
Now that I fell into your arms, my only lover, give out to give him. I search for the castle I lost.
Yeah, so it's such a pretty record, but it's not simple. It's spare, but there are layers upon layers to it. It's going to be one of my favorite albums of the year. I just love it. Carrie and Lowell by Sufjan Stevens.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
There is a new app That's short for application. not talking about hummus here. There is a new app called Star Wars Card Trader. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a bunch of virtual cards, like bubblegum cards that you you can get in packs, and then they're all the different characters, all the different characters. And I am just 7 years old again. It is so smart what these people are doing, and I am so weak in the face of it. But there's all these different characters. And of course, each character, as they go through the series, there's different versions of them that you can collect. Let's take a Wedge Antilles, for example. You can have the X-Wing pilot Wedge Antilles. You can have the Snowspeeder pilot Wedge Antilles. And then you can get the Rogue Leader Wedge Antilles. And the really sick thing about it is that there are 4 different varieties of each of those cards. You can get the white bordered Wedge Antilles. You can get the blue bordered, the red bordered, or the yellow bordered. The white bordered is, of course, very common. Puh, spit on it. And the yellow is very, very rare. Then you can trade them. Now, I never understood the nerd affinity for Boba Fett. Doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know why you dig that character. But when I opened a pack and I got this guy right here, Stephen, read it out.
Jack Porkins.
Jack Porkins. the red Jack Porkins, you'll notice.
Right.
The good one.
The good one. I actually fist bumped. Me, a person not giving to fist pumping, was like, yes. Now, again, you can trade with other people.
Oh,
I find that when I trade with people I know, it's fine. It's all above board. But you can also kind of send out, like, I need this card. And you can send it out to the vast internet, and they can attempt to trade with you. And that is always people. Y'all are greedy out there. Like, I'll send out a thing, I need X. I'll need Mon Mothma, for example, and I'll get this people coming back wanting like seven bushes. I'm like, no.
How dare they?
No, I need
monsters. All.
I need.
Okay.
Leave me one boosh.
Back up slightly. How are these cards doled out by the universe? Do you buy them?
Well, you buy credits, and with those credits, you can buy...
With real money.
Well, with real money. So, but, or because if you collect things in a certain way, then you get a dose of credits from the organization that can then you can then use to buy other packs.
Interesting. And all this just exists within the application?
On your phone.
It does. It's the funnest thing. It is so stupid. I recognize how stupid it is, just how very stupid
all
it is, and
weird
how many I have.
Things that you've been into, this might be the
sometimes
weirdest.
they'll do vintage cards, which means that they are exact duplicates of the cards I had when I was 7 years old.
Sure.
So you flip them over, and it's that language that had it just internalized itself in my head, like seared itself in my forebrain, and it's there back again.
But it's not like you, I mean...
You can't do anything with them. Nope,
but
not
like
a thing.
You could just, I'm assuming that somewhere in the everything in the universe available at one time, internet, like you could download a PDF... Like a bootlegged PDF of like every Star Wars card ever. You could go to a website and scan.
But
I'm
these
sure
are not, these are created just for the app. I don't think that was. Did I not make that clear?
Application.
Right. Thank you.
Also,
there's this thing where you can go and click over from one screen that says My Cards to All Cards, and then you can just scroll through everything. So it's kind of like you have them all.
Yeah.
But they're not yours. You see, is the
interesting.
Is the
this is the weirdest
it's
thing.
It's dumb.
You've
it's
ever
dumb.
Heard.
I'm not saying it's not dumb.
Ooh. All right. Well,
it's incredibly satisfying.
That is fascinating, Glenn Weldon. Thank you very much. Cat Chow, what is making you happy this week?
How do I top that? I don't even know how. Well, okay. So the Toast every now and then has this semi-regular column called If Blank Person Were Your Boyfriend or Girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And John Cho was featured. And Nicole Sujung Callahan wrote this awesome list of basically imagining what it would be like to date John Cho. And I'm going to read some of my favorites because it really speaks to me because... I actually do envision every now and then what life would be like if John Cho were my boyfriend. I'm not even kidding. And I think many of us in the room could relate.
Don't we all?
Yeah,
I'll
sign on to that.
So dreamy.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, okay. If John Cho were your boyfriend, you would finally stop feeling insecure about the shape of your ears. I think they're one of the cutest things about you, John Cho would tell you. They remind me of little seashells. Seashells. I wish John Cho would tell me that. Maybe he'll call me up and read this to me. And then my other favorite is, if John Cho were your boyfriend, he would always carry Lactaid Fast Act caplets in his pockets because he would know that you never remember to bring any with you and yet are unable to deny yourself ice cream. And I mean, that's just so real. And I can totally, I mean, if you just want to gorge yourself on ice cream
fantastic.
Yeah, but I think of all of the If So-and-So Were Your Significant Other series, this was my favorite because it really spoke to me. And it kind of got at the sad, there were some sad selfie jokes in there about the cancellation that
it made it
more deep.
Mm. Yeah,
you know? Made it more real for you.
I know. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Kat Chow. That was delightful. What is making me happy this week is a piece in the New York Times Magazine by former Pop Culture Happy Hour contributor Parul Sagal.
Sure. Once and future. She's coming back. I
Once
just know it.
Once and future. In which she investigates the term flawless. She traces its current usage and what she calls its celebratory sheen back to a drag performer named Flawless Sabrina, and up through its usage by Beyonce and a lot of women on Instagram. She talks about selfies taken by people who feel, as she puts it, painfully at the margins. And she says this: "The subjects of these photos wrest beauty from the eye of the beholder. It is not granted, but announced. And here the word wends its way home to its original definition. Flaw once evoked a shard. Now flawless has come to mean plainly, powerfully, something unbroken, something defiantly whole." Online, this piece appears under the headline, "How Flawless Became a Feminist Declaration." But you got to see the print magazine in which it appears under the giant, and I do mean giant, words, "Bow Down." It is a fantastic piece. It is Parul doing some really fantastically beautiful writing, evocative, interesting, historically thorough, analytical, and I cried a little.
Yeah.
I might have cried a little.
There's a word for the kind of writing she did. I just can't come up with it right now.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing piece, and I will link to it enthusiastically, and congratulations to her for that super fantastic piece of work. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the show at NPRPCHH. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon. You can follow Kat at KatChow. That's Kat with a K. Chow. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And our producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? He kinda does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at npr.org/podcasts.